Welcome to the Trauma Informed Lens Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Bennett. Each episode, we talk about the research and practical aspects of the trauma informed movement. This podcast is not designed to replace mental health services. If you feel uncomfortable or triggered by our discussion, please consider seeking your own trauma treatment. In no way is seeking treatment an admission of weakness. It is a chance to build resiliency and experience post-traumatic trauma. You can find show notes, resources, and more at traumainformedlens.org. Welcome, friends, to the Trauma Informed Lens Podcast. I'm here with a very special guest today, Dr. Jeff Spies. Dr. Spies, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here, Matt.
We are going to talk about your expertise today around end-of-life issues. And we know for those of us in the trauma field, disease, death, all these issues come into play. I'm interested to really talk from the individual experiencing this and your expertise there, but also the family members who are dealing with as well. And obviously in a time where we have a pandemic going on, I know a lot of the organizations I work with who are working with already vulnerable populations have suffered death of their clients and patients at alarming rates. So I think the timing of this conversation couldn't be better. So welcome to the show. And I'll give you a chance to give a more formal introduction of yourself and your work before we jump into the topic.
Okay, great. So I'll give you the quick and dirty here. I've recently retired from medical practice.
Congratulations.
It's a good thing. Good thing. Practicing was a good thing too.
Yes.
But retirement is an even better thing.
Yeah.
And grandchildren make a difference.
Yes.
Okay. So I trained in hematology and oncology, and for the first 15 years or so in my practice was in private practice on oncology. Through that time, I became increasingly interested in the people a little more than the diseases, and then gradually more and more than the diseases. And I started as a volunteer hospice medical director with a small not-for-profit hospice very soon after I started oncology practice, because for me, that was just part of the job, you know, and I learned tremendous things there. And particularly of value is meeting my patients as they were closing the ends of their lives in their own homes, and to encounter really even more who these people were. I had a chance to shift gears in, I think it was 2001, had an opportunity to jump back into the academic world, and was at the University of Iowa, where I made my salary by seeing cancer patients, but also served as the inpatient palliative care director. And then starting in late 2005, I switched to total end-of-life care with as a hospice doc. And as I mentioned, I retired recently from that. I took throughout working with people who are seriously and terminally ill, I would become distressed by what I perceived or what I saw as suffering or distress that really didn't have to be. Maybe it had to be at the moment, but could have happened and could have been headed off. And I became convinced that part of the reason for that is that we as humans, and we as Americans even more so, don't like to think that we're mortal, and don't think that we're mortal. We know it up here, but we don't know it down here. And so we're afraid to talk about it. And because we're all afraid to talk about it, the decisions don't get made in a good way, in an expeditious way. So I had been playing with writing something for the last 10 years or so. And finally, a book that's going to be released very shortly here called Dying with Ease, in which there's lots of nuts and bolts about how death and dying happen in America, but there's also a lot about how to encounter your own mortality and have it be okay, that it doesn't have to be frightening and scary and stuff like that. So that's kind of who I am and what I've been about here lately.
Excellent. And is that your book behind you? I think I see it.
Oh, yeah. Yes, actually. Yeah, yes. Yeah.
I think when it comes out, it should be like 2 days before publication or so.
Yeah, something like that. Yes. But yeah, you can go to any, go. So we'll put the plug at the beginning instead of the end.
Yeah.
Local bookstores are great, but Amazon and BNN and everybody's got it. So
absolutely. I'm on the site right now. So we'll link to all that in the show notes.
Okay,
so thanks. So I'd like to ask you a question because, you know, in my work, having had a few, you know, clients of mine pass away, a lot of them with complex medical histories, and also usually things like homelessness, other things, mental health, as well as a lot of physical health issues. And I'm not going to say this is a vast experience, but one of the things I've always really struggled with without the expertise that you have is, you know, for a lot of folks, there seems to be this great fear of facing death, and others seem to just kind of give up, not in a way that I see is where I want them to be therapeutically, but just sort of like, I'm done. You know, in the HIV arena where I do some work, we have some folks who are just like, I'm not going to take my medication anymore. I'm just sort of tired. And that sense of kind of hopelessness kind of takes over. And I just, you know, as we think about, you know, maybe folks with histories of trauma, you know, just as somebody who's really focused a great deal of your career on this end of life thing, what are some of the issues that folks are really struggling with? And then I know this is a huge question, so I'll give you as much of a runway as you want for it. You know, what are some approaches to help counter, again, sometimes I experience this hopelessness, other times great anxiety and fear, and just would love to get your thoughts on that huge question to start us out.
Well, huge is a good word. As you were posing that question, I thought you said this was 45 minutes to an hour because I think we could be here for about 4 weeks. But that's okay.
I by the way, I'm famous for asking the 4 week questions.
That's good. It's a good thing. It's a good thing because trauma, at least for me. Not for me personally, we can do that if you want to, but that's a whole nother world. But trauma from in the hospice world is a relatively new paradigm, not, you know, brand new, but as the whole idea of trauma-informed care. And once you start to look at it, you just see how gigantic it is in the individual, in the family. So I'm done here. That's I think an apt way to go currently, because that's one of the things that has happened. I don't think these are counted as COVID deaths, but suicide rates are not, well, let's just say they're not going down in this period of time. Because the living every day with the uncertainty is a traumatic event. And I think that's a part of a trauma that is really hard. One of my favorite quotes is from Anton Chekhov, and he said, "Any idiot can handle a crisis. It's the day-to-day living that kills you." And I think that's absolutely true. In the hospice world, this gets played out most obviously for me, the patient and family who are ready. Mm-hmm. They're ready to go. They're geared up. They've gotten mom home. they've all figured out their shifts, how we're going to do this, and they're just really enjoying their time with their mother, and mom doesn't die. Nah, doesn't die. Well, she's dying, but I got to get home. I got to get, you know, I got this project to work. I got to do this, you know, and this is, but how do you do that? Because that's like, what do you mean that project is more important than my mother? And I remember when I was a kid, I did lots of things that I never told my mother about. And so I'm feeling extra guilty about that. But if I don't, you know, get this done, then I won't get that promotion and my kids won't be able to go to a good college and all this kind of stuff. I mean, all of those are traumas. And I have a very good friend that was for a long time a social worker in the hospice organization I worked with, and now is an independent counselor. And she is convinced that so much of what we see at the bedside in the relationships, in the suffering, are the result of longstanding or far back trauma. This probably isn't going anywhere where you wanted it to go.
No, but I think you're answering what one of my themes I hope we talk about is that, you know, how is, one of my just interests, and I think when I see this giving up or this anxiety, it is at least somewhat rooted in past unresolved trauma. It's almost right. Like I may be so sad at how my story is ending and my story hasn't been good, you know, or I've got so much guilt or shame that I'm not going to be able to resolve. And so, right. You know, in many ways that's the root of my question is working with highly traumatized populations. It doesn't seem in my limited experience that the transition into, you know, the last days, so to speak, are usually pleasant, are usually, like you said, you know, when my grandparents passed away in the last 5 or 6 years, you know, it was hard, but it was also a chance to come together, a chance to celebrate life.
Right. Right.
Very different from the clients I've worked with who've experienced right. homelessness and other things. So yeah, it just seems like it manifests in ways that makes the experience really hard for everybody involved.
And I think I do want to come back to one thing, but just one thing you just said, that I would imagine that your homeless population, and it's certainly in the folks that I've dealt, the at-risk populations that I've worked with, one way to deal with trauma is to have somebody else hold it up with you. Yeah. To have somebody else be there and bear it with you. And if you are the estranged person that's perhaps got a poorly treated mental illness or addiction problem or just estranged from the family and never figured it out, who you got? You know, you just got yourself, and it's been everything you can do to just live from day to day. It is everything you could do. And I think that's one thing that the hospice team, which really is, can help with, is to at least, as best as people will let you, to ask the questions and be there for the sharing of the whatever it is. I do think that trauma, interferes, but at least affects what happens at the end of life. So a few examples that seem to be patterns. Holocaust survivors who clearly went through unbelievably traumatic events 75 years ago now. There's a couple things about that population. One is they don't tend to want to give up. They don't tend to want to lay down and die, because for the past 75 years, they're informed by what happened in the 40s when they did everything they could do to survive. And that's what informed their whole life. Some that works out okay, for some it doesn't. The veteran population, the organization I worked with has a very strong, intervention is not a really a word, but support program for veterans who many of whom had never been able to tell their story. My dad, I know, went through some traumatic episodes in when he was in Korea. He alluded to it once in a class he was teaching at church, but never ever did I hear him talk about what it felt like to shoot that person trying to climb over the wall. He never talked about it. I mean, how do you, and no matter how, you know, how do those things affect? So anyway, there's that pieces. The other way that I see it all the time is in what looks like guilt. Mom is the one who is dying. The daughter either doesn't want mom to go or wants her to do it differently. It isn't always moms and daughters, but that's kind of the prototype here. An example I use is, unfortunately, we don't see docs do this as much anymore. When a patient who's clearly very ill and is likely to die very soon shows up in the emergency room for whatever reason, and the discussions are being held as far as what to do here with mom. Do we send her to the ICU? Do we not? Do we make her comfortable? And the question always used to be asked, well, what do you want us to do? Well, if I'm the daughter and I know that I feel guilty that my mom's disappointed in me, and you're asking me if I want to kill my mom, that's really not a good place to be. But if the question is, you know your mother, in this situation, what is she telling us to do? Then I get to be the good girl. I get to do what mom wants me to do. And that makes all the difference in the world. It's maybe the same decision, but I walk away rather than being traumatized by my guilt yet one more time as being relieved and forgiven and reconciled.
Yeah, another question I asked, and this is kind of maybe coming a little bit out of left field, but I found it really interesting that there's this whole movement in psychology to go back to our kind of things that were researched a few decades ago and see, hey, is this true? And some of these things I compare it to, like, I'm old enough now to remember when we weren't supposed to eat fat. Fat was terrible for you. So we put sugar in everything. And then now we know sugar's terrible for you. But every processed food is painful. So it's like there's in psychology, they're not kind of as well known. But, you look at this. And one of the things I heard probably about a year ago, and I haven't followed up too much on it, but it just kind of made me reset is, you know, how we usually think about grief, the stages of grief. When they researched that, they didn't really find that held true. But I even think for me as I have a master's in psychology, I haven't thought about it since grad school. So I was kind of still holding on to that model as, hey, let me help you grieve by giving you an understanding of the process you're going to go through. And then I learned that process is no longer valid. So I'd love to just get has there been work to, help people and understand this process? Because I know for people like myself who may be too in my head, an intellectual understanding of, hey, this is going to be the process that I go through loss. I just kind of, out of interest, are there things evolving of how we look at grief, both that we might go through, but also how to support people in that process as well?
Yeah, I'm not really a grief specialist, but I do understand your question and what you're saying. And you're right. The stages of grieving, just like the stages of dying that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross put forward a few decades ago, are a great model. Mm-hmm. And probably most people do go through most of those stages sometime in the process. but the number who go through one and then I'm transitioning into number two and then transitioning to number three doesn't happen very often.
Unless they probably read the book and then they...
Yeah, that's right.
I really wonder if some of these studies, you know, create these truths in how we experience the world, but go ahead.
Well, no, I think that's true because that's good for me because, you know, I'm kind of that kind of a guy. If I know how to do something and I know this is step one and this is step two and this is step three and this is number, whether I'm fixing my sink or whether I'm, you know, delivering bad news to a patient. If I do things in an order, it's kind of like the IKEA thing I put together. I do what the little man does there, and then I do what the next little man does. It'll happen. And that works for me. But I don't think that's the way we're wired. We go through what we go through in the moment. Yeah. And whatever stimulus popped in our head at that moment put us back when we were 12 or put us, you know, into that stage of feeling, oh, I am ready to go now. And I'm so accepting. And then the next minute I'm furious. So I think those things are probably right, but I think the sequence is not frequently observed. That's the way it happens. And people are where they are. But one thing I do like about those things, if they're in the literature, if they're in the counseling, or if you're talking with somebody, is for somebody to recognize, oh, that step three here, that bargaining thing, I recognize that, that's me. And that makes me feel like I'm normal. That because, oh yes, yeah, somebody else felt this, and it's a normal thing, yeah.
Another question I have, because I just want to give him a shout out. I was honored enough to be the keynote speaker for Providence Hospice in Portland about a year or so ago. And just, you know, good I folks, always find that when I'm the teacher, my students, you know, I learn more from them often than I think I teach, which I hope is not true, but I know they have been my greatest teachers in life, whether they're clients or people that I'm working with. And one of the things that I found really powerful was, and this has been another, you know, my connection with hospice as well, is sometimes, you know, how you maintain your own self-care in the work. And you know, I just wonder with your kind of career's worth of experience, you know, in the trauma-informed care world, we talk about, you know, vicarious secondary trauma of having, you know, walking through traumatic experiences with people, and that can be traumatizing for us as well. And, you know, just talking to the folks, great folks that do this amazing work that you've done, you know, some, you know, and the Providence folks, I'll give a lot of credit, seem to have really focused on this aspect of it. Other hospice workers who remain unnamed that I've more had contact with in trainings have really struggled to maintain. I actually had one hospice worker to say, hey, I just work myself to later stages of burnout. I have to quit my job for 2 months and then I go get another job. I'm like, that's no way to live. But I kind of wonder, as you have gone through this experience and, you know, helped people through this, been with families through this experience, loved ones, you know, what challenges have you found to maintain your own health and wellness, and some of the hardest, most intense scenarios you could put yourself in professionally?
Wow. Well, you know, maybe I should run and get my wife and ask her how I did, because she would probably say he didn't do so good. You should have heard him some of those nights when he came home. Of course, when I was ranting, I wasn't ranting about what I experienced at the bedside. I was ranting about the fight with the pharmacy. I was about my supervisor or the system that wasn't allowing me to do what I thought I would do. That's what killed me. One thing that I think is true. Well, so for me, and maybe this is just the way I'm wired, but the being with the patient and family in their suffering, for me, that fed me. that very human experience was nurturing, is nurturing for me. So, and it helped me deal with some of the crap. Mm-hmm. The things that were most traumatic for me is when I saw patients or families who clearly were not going to go the way I thought they were, that would be healthy for them to go. And kind of threw it back in my face. And it's like, oh, I so much want to help. I so much want this to be right. And trying to make it, remember, it's not about me. This is not about me. This is your life to live the best. And I don't know you. I haven't lived with you for the last 70 years. I don't know what you've been through. And that was the hardest for me. One of the things that helped me tremendously is just the little techniques, maybe anticipatory grief isn't right, the anticipatory recognition that, to stop at the door before walking in the room and just think, okay, what's going to happen here? And what's that going to be like? And to just grieve for a moment and recognize this is hard and this is going to be hard for them, and be the, I don't want to say be the best I can be. That sounds like it's probably a copyrighted governmental slogan, but to just recognize the reality of what's happening here. And I think that was tremendously helpful for me, because I think that's, when you go in the room and nobody's recognizing it, when the new kid from out of town comes in and stirs up the pot, some of the neighbors come and says, well, you can't think about that. You got to think positively, it'll be okay. Don't talk that way. And I realize this poor woman, all she wants to say is how she feels. Where am I going here? I don't know where I'm going. You're the psychiatrist. You're doing the train of thought thing, the flight of ideas thing.
No, I love it. Well, it's, I think you speak to one, I love your initial example. In my self-care trainings, I call it expectation burnout. When we're in systems, and I'm not just picking on the medical system, because pretty much any bureaucracy I've been in, there's been a level of frustration, but you have to almost fight the system, to get the level of care and compassion that you want. I don't think we talk enough about that as a cause of burnout for us. So you did a good job of that. And I think, to me that, it's interesting when I've talked to hospice workers, there is the intensity of losing someone you have created a caring relationship, a therapeutic relationship with, but usually that doesn't seem to be, it's the family dynamic sometimes. And here I'm left caring for people within this dynamic, yet the dynamic can be incredibly toxic, no matter how much you want it to be nurturing and peaceful. And, I've seen now that I'm 45 and have, experienced, death firsthand, death of friends, family members. It's like, boy, sometimes the best out of everybody pops up during these times, but usually all those dynamics that may, like you kind of mentioned, were under the surface often pops up as well. And, hospice workers have told me that it's just hard to see, when the dynamics almost won't let the person pass away peacefully. And, I've watched that as part of a team, but usually people have recovered in my experience. So it's like, okay, now let's work on the dynamics, because the clock has been set back, but I know that's not always the case as well.
It's not always the case as well. And another social worker friend who was very good with the one-liners, when we'd come out of a patient's room or home, and I said, what was that about? What was that? What the heck was all that? And she would say, now, Jeff, remember, She made that family. She raised that family. Mm-hmm. You know, that doesn't make it right. It doesn't make this suffering right. It doesn't make their behavior right. This is who they are. And this is the way they have dysfunctioned for the past decades. And this is the way it's going to be. So absolutely. We do the best we can with what we got here.
So I love to, you know, I always ask this question to authors I have on the podcast, because one of the things I've really enjoyed in my own writing books is things that, even though I may have been training on something, doing something, talking about something, obsessing about something for a decade or so, every time I sit down to write in book form, things that surprise me kind of pop up and maybe play a little bit more of importance than what I kind of thought they would before I started putting pen to paper, so to speak. And I wonder if, you know, after a great career in this, is when you were working on the book, did anything surprise you along that journey as you were putting pen to paper and a distinguished career now on the written page?
The thing that pops in my head was the recognition as I was writing of what for the lack of a better term, and maybe it is the right term, we call the spiritual. Mm-hmm. The looking back at the number of what you might call the difficult deaths that we tended to treat with fairly aggressive medications because there wasn't anything else I had to do. Yeah. You know, if they're going to be dead in, you know, 36 hours, I don't have, you know, we don't have time to get all we don't have time to start down a series of psychoanalysis here. That's just not going to happen. So you use drugs. And I always assumed that this was, well, somehow they're in pain that we can't figure out, or they're short of breath, or they're whatever, or maybe the wrong daughter's there, or maybe they're trying to say something. But I became convinced really after in writing and then talking with people again, kind of reflecting on what came out of my pen or mm-hmm. laptop, that much of that I think is deeper. Some people would say that agitation is encountering the beyond that is ugly. I don't know. I'm not there. I don't know. Some people, you know, talk about that as fractured relationships or guilt on that person. I love the word spirit here because no, trying if I can to divorce it from its religious significance, although I'm a religious person, but I know that doesn't speak to everybody. Because that word, of course, refers to breath. The same word as spirit is the word for breath, as we inspire and expire and aspire or aspirate when we choke on something. It is the essence of who we are. Whatever it is, it is who we are. And I'm convinced that a great deal of suffering and solace happens at that level. Mm-hmm. And that's a level that's hard to get to if you're in pain, if you can't breathe and whatever. This is one reason that I became more and more convinced as I was writing this book that I was right in my thesis. And that is that we don't encounter that level of ourselves because just like death is, we're afraid of it. We don't know what it means. I think in America, as Americans, and now I'm going far off my area of expertise, but I think as Americans, this goes exactly against who we say we are. We are the pioneers who conquered the continent. We are the can-do, be in control, impregnable fortress, and nothing can get us. But those parts of ourselves, including especially our mortality, are not in our control. They're to, you know, our spirit is not in our control. It is to be explored, or it is to be discovered, nurtured, whatever word you'll come up with better words than I do. And I've become so convinced about that. That's now kind of the topic of the book I'm playing with now. So I'll see where that goes, because it may turn out to be something totally, totally different. Yeah.
So let me just say, you know, if you're not comfortable going into it, but I would like to open up the spaces, you know, unlike most of us who death is something we experience oftentimes with years between, you know, that experience, as somebody who's been, you know, that's been a part of maybe, I don't know the numbers, but a weekly or, you know, happening. Like from that, if you're open to going a little deeper, what's that taught you about spirituality? You know, any great answers or epiphanies that you could share? Because I think, you know, a lot of times professionally, I always share this story. It's like, you know, we go to a conference all day. We talk about neurobiology, epigenetics. Then we go out for a glass of wine and we're talking about your ayahuasca trip down to Peru last month. Yeah, so, yeah. You know, and your trip to the shaman and your spiritual epiphany. So I would like to open up that space. I wonder if you've had any, you know, has this work kind of changed how you look at, you know, spirit, you know, in that way? I'd love to hear any wisdom that has come out of this for you personally.
Wow. So when I started first encountered the death and dying world, my paradigm, my assumption was that religion was good. Mm-hmm. And that I had the image of, say, my grandmother, who lived to be 99 and taught Sunday school all her life, and she lived to be 99 for the past 10 years of her life. She woke up and wondered why, not because she was depressed, but because she was happy to go, and this is what she knew where she was going, and it was comforting and things. So that's what I thought I would see.
Yeah.
And that is way not what happens. There's very good data that the more religious we are, the more we suffer at the end of life. Huh. The more I have some clergy friends who say, well, it's the religious, but not too spiritual. It's the dogmatic, legalistic, you got to do it this way, religion, that then you can't question, because but what I found was this unbelievable tradition of wisdom in cultures and religions and philosophies that saw death as an intriguing thing, as a positive thing, as a transitioning thing. I think the Tibetan Buddhist idea is fascinating. I don't know if I buy it intellectually, but the point of that spirituality isn't about what happens over there. It's about how you live now. And I think that one of the lines that I used to use all the time in talks is that the number of people who described, they said that I finally figured out how to die, and it is teaching me how to live. Wow. Or how I should have lived. I should have lived in the present, in the moment, happy with who I am, honest in my relationships with other people, accepting and loving and forgiving and all those things. I think that's one thing I've learned from it. The other thing that I've learned in the repetitive deaths, especially the last few years when I was the director of an inpatient hospice unit, where I did death certs every day and sometimes multiple, you know, that's part of it, is I'm not afraid of it. I mean, it's just happens. And I'm not excited. I'm not looking forward necessarily, although some days, you know, it's like, well, maybe it wouldn't be so bad. But it's not anything to be feared. This has nothing to do with trauma or any of this stuff, but one of my favorite scenes in literature, and it's actually, I use it as the beginning of the introduction in my book, is Socrates on trial, who is being accused of, you know, moral turpitude and things, and he's going to be executed. And in his defense, in his apology, he says that to be afraid of death is to be afraid of something we don't know. It's the least logical thing. We don't know that death might not be the absolute best thing that could ever happen. And we don't know, and we're afraid of it. That's just stupid. Now, you know, but I think we're afraid of it because we don't know. Right. We know this.
Yeah.
Some days we really like this. Most days we really like this. Some days this ain't so great, but we're still not ready to go there because we don't know what that's about.
Yeah, absolutely. So this has been an amazing conversation. I guess I'll ask a small question on the way out, since I haven't dropped three or four huge ones on you. For someone like, you know, I'm in my mid 40s, I don't think about death every day, but as I get older, are there any, have you, you know, I guess if we're not going to fear death, we can talk blatantly about it. If somebody is going to die well, you know, because, you know, if death's not something to be feared, you know, I can, you know, go out and shoot a good round of golf or a bad round of golf or whatever it might be. You know, have you seen people, commonalities, I guess, in peaceful passings that seem to, you know, are there best practices, so to speak, from my nerd, I always look for the best practices. Do you have any suggestions for folks that, you know, they're not necessarily in that moment, sure. but, you know, just, hey, you know, if I can start doing some things now, I'm all about following those best practices from experts like yourself. So any knowledge you drop, things to think about.
Yeah, and I think there are a couple. There are two things that come to mind here. One that I put as a chapter in my book, this is the plug, although borrow it from somebody else, get it from the library. It's okay, you don't have to buy it. Although, retirement, you know. And I encountered this early on, maybe back in the 90s, I was at a conference and a spiritual care director from, it was actually from the Cleveland Clinic at the time, but he's moved on, now become a very good friend, led a session on progressive loss and the little deaths that we encounter every day. And he led a session of putting oneself in the position of a person who goes from being healthy and finding a little lump in your neck in the shower and to dying within the next 15 minutes, and then the things that you go through. I found that to be shattering because it's shown the light exactly on how it felt, how it might feel to be the dying person, and what was most important in my life, and then what to do about that. So I tried to translate that into a written out format, and I'll be interested what people think. I've had several people do it and they think it works, so we'll see.
Good.
Let me go though back to there are a couple best practices. I think pick a book. This is a great. This is one Franco Stiseski's.
Pick up your book.
But if you don't want to, Franco Stiseski's book of the Five Invitations is tremendous. B.J. Miller wrote a book on that's really more of a list of nuts and bolts how to do this.
Okay.
But the best advice I've ever encountered was one of the first ones, and this was from a book called Dying Well, written by Dr. Ira Byock back in the 90s. And he identified that commonality, that the what it takes to die well. And he saw that, at least in that at that time, as a series of five tasks. And so now we're, I guess we've circled back to the list, of the tasks.
Yeah.
And you do them in any order. But the tasks were things you need to say before you die. Mm. And they were, forgive me, I forgive you, I love you, thank you, and goodbye. And if you think about the people, because when you hear those questions, you immediately think of that person or this situation or whatever that is still out there. And that this is the what the healing that can lead to the wholeness, that can lead to the good dying or the better dying. And this is another thing to kind of think about every so often, because if you wait until you're going to be dead in 3 days, you don't have time to call up that person and do it. So maybe to think about that list of questions every so often and think, you know, maybe it wouldn't hurt if I went and told her that it hurt, but I forgave her, you know. Or even if you don't tell them and you write the little letter that you burn, whatever, to clear it out of yourself, you'll live better. You'll just be happier and you'll die better.
Yeah, well, I think that's beautiful advice to end this great conversation. So again, Dying With Ease, coming out October 20th. I looked on Amazon. I believe you can pre-order it.
You can pre-order now.
It looks like. So yeah, you'll have about a week for pre-order when this comes out to snag your copy. I'm looking forward to getting one and checking it out. So Dr. Spies, great to meet you. Great conversation. Thanks for sharing your wisdom. We'll put your website, the site of the book, so people can get more information at traumainformedlens.org. And just want to, when you write that next book, please come back and share additional insights from your amazing career. And thanks for all the great work you've done. And I just also appreciate people sharing that wisdom with the world too. I imagine if this conversation is any indication that you're giving the world a gift of all that experience that you've had that we can all learn from. So I thank you for that as well.
And to you all, and to you also, it's been a delight, Matt. Thank you so much.
Thank you.